Tuesday Takeover with Marshall Julius on FUBAR Radio.
That is such a great track, don't you think? I think Stars, We Mean to Continue. There won't be any words in any of the music that we play today. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday Takeover here on Fabulous FUBAR Radio. My name is Marshall Julius. I'm a film critic, a blogger, and a blagger, and just call me a nerd. I've written a book called Vintage Geek. That's the plug done. Anyway, I'm on here till 6 with the minds cranking up the nerdery to 11, maybe even 12. To that end, I've brought help. Joining me today for our Nerdtastic Voyage, I see before me two cracking co-hosts, writer and producer Ron Fogelman.
Hello.
And Fraser, raconteur, actor, producer. Say hello, Fraser.
Hello.
So thanks for coming on the show. Are you feeling good? Are you feeling comfortable?
Very comfortable. Yeah, These seats here at FUBAR Radio are amongst the best in the radio industry. No question at all.
I agree. Yeah. 100%.
I think everybody wants to know that we're comfortable.
Yeah.
So besides Ron and Fraser here, at about 4:15, we'll be joined by double BAFTA-nominated filmmaker and author John Walsh, but you didn't know that. He's chatting about his work with the Ray and Dinah Harryhausen Foundation as its stop-motion wizard Ray Harryhausen's centenary year. There's lots of monster-fueled fun coming into 2020, and we're excited to talk about that.
Are we allowed to make dinosaur noises?
Have you got one?
Yes.
That's very... Yeah, okay, perhaps not. Let's just revise that. After John 1 at around 4:45, we had John 2, Dave Johns, veteran of the stand-up circuit, really very funny bloke, and since taking the lead in Ken Loach's I, Daniel Blake in 2016, he's a full-on film star as well. So we'll be getting all actory with Dave later on. Have you guys seen I, Daniel Blake?
I have.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Have you really?
No.
I'm watching it now on my iPhone. It's great.
It's good, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. I love it.
So finally today at about 5:15, we're welcoming musician Patrick Savage into the studio. Patrick's a distinguished concert violinist, so I don't know what he's doing here. And we're going to try to get him to pluck something for us. Right now he's in the orchestra for Hamilton in the West End. He's also one half of composer duo Savage and Spies. They did The Human Centipede.
The Human Centipede.
First sequence.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I have seen it.
Have you seen that?
Nope.
No.
Christmas movie.
That sounds terrifying. I know kind of what it's about. I've heard it doesn't sound very nice. Anyway, fingers crossed Patrick won't insist on me sewing my lips to his bum hole and we'll be able to engage in audible conversation. conversation. if you guys out there in unregulated radio land would like to get in touch with us, ask questions, contribute to the conversation, or, you know, hurl abuse, we are at FUBAR Radio on everything. Everything being Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can spill your brains over at Marshall Julius on my Twitter. And I think we're, you can email us if you want at takeover@fubarradio.com. I'm also open to telepathic transmissions. And hang on, I'm receiving something. It's my wife, Ruta, telling me, shut up, Marshall, give someone else a chance to speak. So, Ron, yes. Producer of the West End's Mighty Twilight Zone show.
Thank you.
I think I saw it 5 times when it was at the Ambassadors. I saw it,
and that was all in one night.
It was. I just held everyone at gunpoint and made them keep doing it over and over again. It was brutal. Then I saw it at the Almeida beforehand. Then I saw it before. No, that doesn't make sense. At the Almeida. So what's next for the show?
Well, we had a sellout run at the Almeida, which was a fantastic experience. And then we were afforded the chance to take the show to the West End. And we had a lovely season last year. And this was always because of the length and breadth of the material that the original Twilight Zone has. I mean, there were 156 episodes originally. And what we're doing now is thinking about America, which is really the mothership. Most people in England only really know the theme tune. Marshall, can you give us a rendition of the theme tune? It's uncanny. It's almost like there's an orchestra in front of me right now. So most people really know the theme tune. They don't actually even know what the theme tune is, but they know those bars of music. And people also know the terms. So if anything strange happens in the world, and let's face it, there's quite a lot of that right now, they know the Twilight Zone as a term to use when, say, Brexit happens, or if a certain president gets into the United States. So the interesting thing was that the show didn't play here in the 1960s, in parallel with the US, and bringing those stories here for the first time was an amazing experience to an audience that don't know them. Taking it to America will be a different experience because it is really the Old Testament of TV over there. It's the most influential TV show in American TV history.
Yeah, it's a much easier sell in America, isn't it? Because, like you said, so many people here, although it was, significant to us and, our type of nerd, a lot of people really here only know it as a brief sort of reference, don't they?
Well, it comes with a great sense of responsibility. We're working with CBS, with the estates of two of the amazing writers that worked along with Rod Serling, Charles Beaumont and Richard Matheson. And you really don't want to get it wrong. And here, because the show's not so well known, if we made a mistake or didn't do things the way that it should have been done, no one really cared. But in America, they really will do. So we're thinking about what stories work, how to frame the show for America, and hope to get that off maybe in the next 18 months.
I think I mentioned several times I want you to do The Howling Man, and you've already nixed that, but I'm just saying it again.
Well, you just don't know. You see, it's the Twilight Zone. Anything can happen.
It's a really good story. He lets him out, and he turns out to be the devil.
Oh, you've gone... No spoiler alert.
That's basically...
Oh, man, scrap the show now. It's over.
The other thing, because of spending so much time and research, that I'm putting together is a documentary series about the original show, which we also hope to get going on this year, and that should be very exciting too, because the show has influenced everyone from J.J. Abrams, who's probably the world's number one fan, to people like Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad, and Matt Wiener, who did Mad Men. They cite that show as the reason why they got into writing.
And of course, Jordan Peele has his...
Yeah, exactly. There's a new TV show which hasn't come to England yet, but it's the second season starts in America, I think, in April, and they're really upping their game, and I think that's going to be really interesting to see. It's just a timeless series, and the original... We only really look at the original stories back from 59 to 64, but they are a wealth of gold of storytelling.
So, Fraser, I know you've got some extremely exciting theatrical productions coming up, including a stage version of Night of the Living Dead.
George A. Romero's birthday.
I love that movie. Yes, George A. Romero's birthday today. So is that going to be a really very scary show? Are you kind of making it jokey? What's the plan?
No, it's not going to be scary at all. So I announced this show on George A. Romero's birthday a year ago. Since then, there's been two more productions of Night of the Living Dead. So we've sort of...
Nothing to do with you.
Nothing to do with me. And we put it on hold so we weren't sort of oversaturating the market. But we're, it's going to be true to the film. It's going to be a scary experience. It's going to be promenade style. So the audience will be involved at a certain point. It's going to be exciting. And we've got some Hollywood set dresses in to make this thing. We want you to live it.
That sounds terrifying.
Can't wait.
No, I can't wait either. Now, Fraser, I know I had a stalk of your IMDb profile, and I see you're acting in a new film from legendary trauma madman Lloyd Kaufman. It's called Shakespeare's Shitstorm. Shakespeare Shitstorm. And you're playing William Shakespeare.
I am.
Would you care to shed some light on that madness?
Yeah, so I've known Lloyd for a while. Lloyd Kaufman, who runs Troma, the longest running independent film studio in the world, longer than Roger Corman, because Roger Corman sold to Sci-Fi. So he's now the only independent film studio in the world, been running 45 years. Known him for a while. He came to me. He asked me to write some iambic pentameter for the film. This is going to be his... Fraser, this is the last film I'm going to make before I die, he said. So he's planning on that, I guess, at some point. But he asked me to write the iambic pentameter. Then he asked me to read for it, so the actor doing it. Then he said, do you want to be in it? And I said, sure. So I found myself suddenly on set playing William Shakespeare in Lloyd Kaufman's Shakespeare Shitstorm, which is based on The Tempest.
Based on The Tempest. I had a look on the IMDb, and the first picture I saw was a bloke sitting on the sofa and he's got a giant penis instead of a head. So I'm guessing you deviate a little bit from the original story.
We do. Prospero's curses do take on a slightly sexual overtone. There's some very strange stuff in this. I kept myself out of it. Mine's an Oscar-winning performance in it. It's completely separate from
all the... Of course, you'd expect no less.
From all the giant penises. But there are giant penises. There are people being turned into all kinds of weird things.
At the centre of this, Fraser, I remember you telling me that there's a heartfelt reason why you got into this, and it all comes down to a poster in your bedroom when you were a boy.
Yes, that story. Right, so yeah, I grew up with Lloyd Kaufman's posters on my walls, and 8 years of age, I'm sitting there looking at those posters thinking, who is this Lloyd Kaufman? He's doing this comic with Stan Lee, he's doing this comic with Marvel, and here I am. 30 years later in one of his movies. And that came out of nowhere.
Well, I had Linda Carter, TV's Wonder Woman, on my wall.
Sure.
She hasn't turned up. It's really upsetting.
Give it another 30 years.
All right, fair enough.
Okay, now
we're 100 and...
As a subtle way to keep plugging my book, Vintage Geek, throughout the show today, I'll be testing everyone's nerd IQ with a trio of individually fashioned trivia questions. Your chosen category is Stanley Kubrick. So are you ready for your Vintage Geek challenge?
Well, here goes. Can I have a drum roll, please, Fraser? That's a great drum roll.
Thanks. Okay, I don't have a sound effect for that, but if you get it right, you get one of these. And when you get it wrong, you'll get one of these.
Yeah.
Okay, so
you
and
don't
that
want, sound
don't
effect
want that.
Was delivered by Marshall personally.
Yes. Yeah, that was very impressive.
It'll sound the same every single time.
Take it away.
Director Billy Wilder once told director Cameron Crowe that the first half of which Kubrick movie was the best picture I've ever seen?
Paths of Glory.
You said
this was a quiz about Stanley Kubrick, not about Billy Wilder. What do I know about Billy Wilder?
Which one of his films has two very distinct halves?
Oh, it's got to be Full Metal Jacket.
Full Metal Jacket, there you go.
Yeah.
So I thought that...
Point for that?
No, I'll give you this, but it's actually...
Fair enough. What can I say?
Okay, question number two. What activity did Stanley Kubrick compare to trying to write War and Peace in a bumper car in an amusement park?
I would say probably 2001.
No, what activity, not film?
Well, not what activity?
Oh, this question is impossible.
I know, sorry. I'm going to myself because I've got no chance of
directing,
answering
the
question.
Directing a film.
That's
an activity. Yeah,
so
I know.
It seems so hard, and yet it was such an easy answer.
I know.
Don't yourself in public.
Can
just
I just
the
check
station.
That technically...
No, technically. Great. Question number three.
I just want to get a running tally. Am I right in saying that two questions I've got zero?
Yeah.
Right, okay, good. No pressure then.
Okay, question number three. Though he was nominated for 13 Academy Awards over the years, ultimately Stanley Kubrick only won once. In what category and for which movie did he win?
Special visual effects for the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey.
No, that's good. Quit where you're ahead.
And I've seen it. I've actually seen it because it was at that amazing exhibition, probably the best exhibition of film ever at the Design Museum.
That was incredible, wasn't it? When I saw his Oscar, I thought it was like a mistake. It's like because he didn't do the special effects for the movie. I mean, he did. He designed the film. It was very much him and Arthur C. Clarke, but he did not do the special effects.
Or did he? Did he stay in his garage doing every single aspect?
Well,
of it?
Interestingly, I'm reading the Taschen book on 2001 right now, and it's amazing how involved he was really on every aspect of filmmaking. This is no stone was left unturned. Everything was considered. The number of times that models were rejected because they had a slight scratch on or because they weren't using the right materials. He was pretty thorough.
That was good. I'm going to give you, for the extra information.
Well, thank you.
That's
thank
very
you.
Impressive. I think
I'm feeling a bit better about myself now. I was, you know, the first two questions, I felt disappointed.
Okay, right, let's take a breather and listen to some music. Excellent. We have Bernard Herrmann's Overture from the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad on... What better way to introduce our first guest today than with that exotic theme from Ray Harryhausen's Seventh Voyage of Sinbad? Ray, of course, being the ultimate practitioner of stop motion special effects, and our guest here, John Walsh. Hello, John.
Good afternoon, James.
Being a trustee of the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, which preserves Ray's extensive collection and furthers the art of model stop motion animation. Hello, John. Do you have a basement full of Ray Harryhausen toys?
I wish I did, but sadly no. Oh. But there is a basement full of, or a large archive full of his entire collection, 50,000 pieces.
50,000 pieces? What, most of them made by himself?
Well, created for his production, so whether it's paperwork and photography or the creatures themselves. So we have 50,000 items, which makes it the largest outside of the Walt Disney Company.
Wow.
And amazing. It's much cooler, obviously, because it's Ray Harryhausen.
Do they include the skeletons from Jason the Argonaut?
Yeah, that's my question.
Yes, all of them. And the original skeleton, which was from Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, because he actually became one of the children of the Hydra's teeth for Jason and the Argonauts. Huh. And we can identify which one he is.
And can I have one?
No.
Okay.
Worth a try. Can we all have
worth
one?
No.
Okay. John's actually nodding, but okay, let's... Now, look, there's a lot of love still for Ray Harryhausen and his style of effects. They're not as slick as computer-generated creatures, and I think there's more life in them because of that. I often post about Ray's films on Twitter, and people regularly bemoan the soulless effects of today, saying how they wished his style of effects were still being used. Is that realistic, though? I mean, do you think... that people are just speaking nostalgically, and actually if we did stop motion on everything, live action as well as animation, that people would really go for that?
Well, look, it's a question we regularly get asked, you know, is it an extinct technique? Well, there's more stop motion on television and in cinema today than there was at any time when Ray was working. So there are more exponents of it, from James and the Giant Peach, Box Trolls...
Coraline,
the Isle of Dogs, you know, there's all those wonderful stop motion films that Tim Burton kind of inspired.
Even Animalisa, I don't know if you saw that, the Charlie Kaufman movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so there's more of it. So the technique's still relevant. Can it be used in a mainstream remake, if you like, of one of Ray's films? Well, that's what we're in the process of doing. You know, we have the unmade follow-up to Clash of the Titans, Force of the Trojans, which is in official development now. And so that's the question we get asked. Will there be stop motion? What happens to CG? And, you know, what did Ray think of CG? Did he hate it? You know, and he didn't. He saw it as an extension of what he was doing. You know, colour was an extension of his work when colour came in, when widescreen Anamorphic came in, he adopted that. They nearly filmed in 3D. So Ray would have eventually have... He was an innovator, so he would have embraced new technologies. So eventually he would have got round to computers, I guess, but he saw it as a digital pencil.
When I was a kid, Ray Harryhausen was the first filmmaker, the first behind-the-scenes person that I was ever aware of. And, we would go and see films because they were presented as Ray Harryhausen films. And certainly, I mean, before we were interested in any directors, or really any actors, to be honest, we knew what we were going to get from that. It was a guarantee of something special. It was, something beyond the kind of rubbery antics of Doug McClure films, although I do love Warlords of Atlantis, or Men in Suits from Godzilla films. I really hated Men in Suit Godzilla movies, or just blown up photography of lizards and people reacting
with a fin sellotape to the back.
Yes.
I remember seeing Ray give a talk, and it was amazing, and he brought some of the models with him at the Royal Horticultural Hall in, my lord, 1980.
Gosh.
Where he gave a talk about how the effects were rendered, how he pioneered them, and actually showed us he had a skeleton, and I think he had something called Clash of the Titans. He was a phenomenal man.
He was. He was an industry in himself. So he would create the creatures. He would write the storylines. He was co-producer of the films. He would do the animations, the lighting, the miniature sets, and so on. So he was the only person involved in those sequences.
Was Ray extremely important to you when you were a kid?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I used to go to the cinema to see those sorts of films. When I was an 18-year-old film student, which was only a couple of years ago, Marshall.
Yes.
I met him when I was a film student and made a documentary about his life and work. So I stayed in touch all the years, and I became a trustee of his foundation. So we would talk about, new trends, whether it's in television or film, or the re-release of his films. He was very excited when DVD came along, and then later on Blu-ray. So there was lots of questions around to what extent you should and can restore his work. And we had a kind of a little debate around the kitchen table as to how far that should go. And it went something like this. He got a call from Columbia Pictures, that's looked after now by Sony and do a very good job. They were doing the Blu-ray for Jason and the Argonauts. And Ray said to me, I've been contacted by Grover Crisp, who's the head of the archive there at Sony. It's a wonderful name, Grover Crisp.
It sounds like a Muppet. Yeah.
Well, or it sounds like a biscuit, doesn't it? Would you like a Grover Crisp?
I would like a Grover Crisp.
Have you got one? Wish I had. And
can I have a Grover Crisp light, please? Yes.
Or an Oreo version.
Sponsored by Grover Crisp.
And so he said, look, Ray, we're doing the remaster. We're going to stabilise the image. Of course, we're going to give it stereo sound. We're going to remove any dirt and scratches, which is standard. Do you want any string or wire removal? Because in high definition, you can see that. And I was like, no. And Ray was like, oh, I think I will. And I was like, what's your choice? And so there was a bit of a debate about, is that a step too far? Is that colouring the past? But Ray went on to colour his black and white film. So but there you go.
Still, I want to see the strings and the wires.
Do you know something? Yeah. I grew up with people like Marshall, who is can we declare this on radio?
Yeah, go for it.
We're Marshall and myself are cousins.
Oh, cousins.
Okay? Just wanted to get that out there and declare it. But so when I grew up, I had to put up with people like Marshall. But one of the amazing things is that in Los Angeles, Ray became very close friends with Ray Bradbury, who, the fantasy author of Illustrated Man and the Martian Chronicles. And you just think, wow, imagine just two incredible people that contributed so much to the genre, becoming lifelong friends from childhood, and then working together, I think, on Beasts from 20,000 Fathoms.
They did. That
was amazing.
They worked on that. There was another project they didn't work on, but as men, they were polar opposites. Mm. Ray Bradbury was outspoken, an outspoken liberal who would decry a production if he didn't like it. Martian Chronicles, he did the press tour of that, just slating it to every member of the press that would sit in front of him, saying, I hate this series, I hate what they've done to my book. And whereas Ray Harryhausen would say pretty much nothing at all if somebody wanted him to do a bit of gossip about a film person. He famously based Medusa on someone who is a famous Hollywood actress, and he wouldn't say until she died who that was. Whereas I imagine Ray Bradbury would have just been like, I'll tell you who it is.
Who was it? We've got the same question.
Well, I think Marshall knows the answer to this, but if you guys want to have...
Let's ask a quiz question. Can you get your buzzer and your thing ready? Who was it, Marshall? Do you know? Guess.
No, you go for it.
I don't know who it is. I'm asking you.
Now, when I reveal it, think about her face, the lipstick and the very high brow line of Medusa, Joan Crawford.
I had no idea.
Yeah, so when I do tours and talks at Comic-Con, we put the pictures together and people go,
And Joan Crawford famously had a head full of snakes as well, didn't she?
She did, and when people looked at her, at least a part of them turned to stone.
Yeah, it was very...
in her young years.
This is very harsh. Very, very harsh. Yeah.
Before the watershed as well, I'm quite shocked. For listeners,
you can say anything
red.
You want, as long as it's amusing. So,
I'm off then.
Now, look, at the end of most blockbusters today, when the credits just go on and on and on, don't they? And you often see like thousands of names. I mean, literally it's thousands of names sometimes who worked on the effects. Multiple effects houses, some people just coming in to do, hair on the Rocket Raccoon's head and smoke effects. And it's enormous. When I think that actually Ray... Yes, just did the effects all by himself in his workshop in his house in London. Mm. And that he did have some help, but it was his mum made the costume sometimes, dad made the armatures.
Yeah. On some of the early films. Yeah.
Well, he did it all himself.
The fact is, I mean, it's art. I mean, the work of the foundation, which is excellent, is yes, some aspects of storytelling might seem a bit dated. We do everything in our house to encourage our kids to watch old movies and get the vocabulary so they can appreciate them. And I have to say that my youngest boy, youngest son, Leo, he resists old movies most of the time. But I put on Seventh Voyage of Sinbad for him. Mm. And it was just created a sense of wonder. He's just completely transfixed. And it didn't matter that some of the effect techniques were 50 years old. He absolutely loved it. So, yeah, bring the sequel on for Clash of the Titans. Bring it all back. It's lovely.
Well, look, from a commercial point of view, the film, some of them have been scanned in 4K. I had a 4K premiere screening of Seventh Voyage of Sinbad last year at the Regent Street Cinema. There's money to be made. You know, Sony are not doing this to keep us happy. Yeah. They're doing this because there is a market for... back catalogue releases, scanning now in 4K. If we all have 4K machines here, put your hands up. Is it just me?
I don't like 4K.
No, but actually between us, we've got 4K. Okay. If we add our machines together.
I got most of a K.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got most of
a K. Well,
you
know, films like The Shining and all that are being re-released, and it's wonderful, you know, to be able to see more detail. And if people are going to pay yet again, the Star Wars films are coming out in 4K, which will be interesting because two of them were shot in 2K.
So are they going to play them both on on top of the other or something? Yeah, because that's really going to be
confusing. Is Hayden Christensen going to be every
speed.
Character? Is that, I mean, you know,
possibly.
As opposed to just... Yeah.
Possibly.
Do you actually like 4K? A good friend of mine, I went to his house, I watched a load of 4K movies, and he was, like, really excited about it, and I was thinking, this just looks horrible. I mean, it's like real life. It's like looking out of a window, but I do not watch films because I want them to be like real life. I want that kind of layer of kind of sheen.
I agree. It's the settings. So if you have it at the factory setting you receive your television in, it will look like it's videotape. Whereas to give it that proper strobe effect of a cinema screen, you need to go into your settings and remove some of the HDRs. You need to turn them off. Mm. So you can kind of trial and error that. But once you get it right, it will work and it will be lovely.
Or you could just watch a Blu-ray
or a VHS.
Yes.
Glorious 240.
You could do that. But, I mean, let's put 4K down now. Now, John, you've written a wonderful book called Harryhausen and the Lost Movies, just in case you'd forgotten. You have written it. It's a wonderful book. It's full of incredible art and info on the many, many projects that Ray tinkered with over the years but didn't quite manage to make. When you were researching this book, were you kind of surprised by the sheer number of films that Ray wants to get made that never happened?
Yes, because Ray would speak about the films that were made, fine. When I used to ask him, what about Sinbad Goes to Mars? Well, I don't want to talk about that. And I thought, oh, okay.
Well, can't we just interview Ray Harryhausen here?
That's very
good.
Channel.
That is really good.
Really,
I shouldn't really do that, but Vanessa, his daughter, said it's fine. And when you know him for that many years, his voice, he sounds like Charlton Heston to me in my head. So when I first met him, he's very tall and massive fingers. So I'd ask him, you know, what about these other films?
Sorry, that's a lot of detail.
That should be his biography title.
That's amazing, actually, that he could do all that fine work with massive fingers, because I can't even text properly.
And I've seen you try and make an Airfix kit. It's a disaster.
A little known fact is all of those miniatures were, in fact, 200 foot high. So he uses massive fingers.
Well, his daughter described his hands as bunches of bananas,
right?
Because they were like that. So Ray would be reluctant to talk about the films that are unmade because it's quite a painful creative experience to go through and recount those stories. So when we came to put the book together, instead of having one person do the foreword, I contacted different filmmakers I knew and said to them, well, look, this is what Ray Harryhausen has in the cupboard. What about you, John Landis? What about you, Guillermo del Toro, John Borman, Mike Hodges, and Nicholas Meyer, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan? Quite a mix of filmmakers there, all fans of Ray Harryhausen, and they all told me something about their own unmade projects in relation to raise vast amount of unmade projects. And it was a form of therapy. They all felt a bit better because they didn't realise Ray had nearly 80 projects that were unrealised. 80, can you imagine?
That's crazy.
And he moved here, didn't he? He lived here.
He lived here since the early 1960s.
Which is, so two of the greatest filmmakers, particularly in genre, Stanley Kubrick and Ray, moved to England, which you find, you know, well away from the centre of filmmaking. Yeah. That's quite interesting, and possibly for the same reason.
No.
No?
Because Ray moved here specifically for the yellow sodium backing process, which was cheaper to do through Rank Laboratories than it was to do through Deluxe.
Yeah, you idiot. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's kind of
you're such a moron. You know, go away, go away.
That was exactly the same reason why Stanley Kubrick...
But it was the right sentiment. I was
yellow sodium process, obviously.
Sorry. Don't want to cause a family friction here. It's not Christmas, is it? You know?
It's all right. I'm always put in my place, so I'm used to this part of the studio.
I mean, realistically, Ray would have needed three or four lifetimes at the rate that he worked. I mean, the Jason and the Argonauts skeleton sequence, how long did that take? Like four and a half months or something?
It did, yes. And originally the film sequence for that was going to be set at night time. It was going to be set in hell. So when you see the seven-headed Hydra, the seven-headed Hydra is guarding the entrance to Hades. And so when Jason takes the fleece, he flees into Hades because he's chased there by the Hydra. And there he disturbs dead soldiers. And they come to life from their graves and attack him and his men. The censors said, no, if you want a family certificate, no. So you cannot set a bewitched sequence like that at twilight or nighttime. It has to be, you know, brunch.
They were like, how much yellow sodium have you been drinking?
I mean, I know everyone defaults to the skeleton sequence as the standout scene, but I remember seeing when I was five on TV, and it would have been in black and white. That's the first time I saw Jason, but it's Talos. He's just an amazing creation and just intimidating and unrelenting, and I just seeing him, and also the way that the Jason and his team, the Argonauts, knocked him out, that itself is just incredibly inventive and powerfully visual. But that's the one for me.
Well, it's great. You know, it's a great sequence. And these films are regularly talked about, re-released. Jason's in 4K, so we're hoping a 4K release of that will be coming out shortly.
So through your research, obviously, you know about every film that he wants to make that he didn't make. But is there one that you find particularly heartbreaking? Like if you could go back in time and you could say, Ray, I'm going to give you the money, I'm going to make it happen. And he would say, OK, but let's just use the time travel machine.
He'd get his fingers ready, his big banana fingers. He'd click them together.
He would get his banana fingers and he would say, which one well, is it that you would like to make?
I think the one which would change his trajectory. You know, we talk about the butterfly effect. You know, when you do one thing, it changes everything. When Ray envisaged War of the Worlds before George Powell, it would have been on tripodded legs. Ray did sketches, Ray did paintings. He also did test footage of the Martians, which you can see in my book.
And on YouTube, probably.
Was it period clips. Set? Or
and it was pretty much period set. Okay. So, the interesting thing about it was that he discussed that with George Powell, who then went and secured the rights for himself.
Ooh.
And And that's not the only time that happened. It happened again.
With George Powell.
With George Powell. For Time Machine.
George Powell just stayed at home with a notepad waiting for him to ring and went, right, yeah, okay. Sounds like a good idea, mate. That's what terrible.
So, you know, I mean, I'm...
Producers, huh?
Producers, yeah. Who'd have
scum. The worst. Scum of the earth.
But, you know,
Twilight Zone comes out later this year from me.
They were good friends. You know, George Powell and Ray Harryhausen were good friends. So it's often the case that if we were all producers, we might be chasing the new John Grisham book and, you know, one of us might get it. So not me, I'm not interested. But, you know, if we were producers of a certain
genre. Interested?
I'm good.
I yearn to tell the story of a man with banana hands.
Yes,
now.
Yes, Mr. Banana Hands.
That's what I was going to call it. Damn you, Fraser. Okay, June 29 this year marks the centenary of Ray's birth. Obviously, sadly, he's no longer with us, but his films are and his fans are. You're working hard, I know, on various centenary events and celebrations for the summer. What can you tell us what we can expect?
Well, we have a major exhibition taking place in Scotland at the National Gallery's exhibition space at the museum there, National Gallery of Scotland. And we're having the entire collection on show for the very first time in its fully restored state. So our conservator has been working on all of the creatures. I saw the full-size kraken, which is a full size of a man's torso, so about this sort of size. For people watching on radio, they can't tell what I'm doing, but I'm pointing to the top of my head and my midriff. And
Picture that, everyone.
Or well, maybe do. I describe him as Love Island Kraken because he looks really now buffed up and looks amazing. So the creatures will be seen better than ever before. We're going to show some footage, test footage from Ray's films and so on. So there's lots to see in screenings. We're doing, I think, some stuff with the Edinburgh Film Festival as well. We're also touring the exhibition. We're working with the Oscars Museum on their launch, which will be December this year. And we're speaking to the Lucas Museum of Narrative Film and Arts.
When does that open?
I'm not sure. But they've asked us to be part of that, so we've said yes.
Well, gents, I think we've got a road trip to Scotland.
When's the opening party?
Sounds amazing.
That's great.
Busy year.
I saw the San Diego Comic-Con are doing, they've asked for art commissions as well for Harryhausen for the brochure. Which I thought was lovely.
Yes.
I think it's going to be lovely to see.
So moving on from Ray, now I know you're also a huge fan, John, of the camp cult classic Flash Gordon, as are we all, I'm assuming. 40 years old this year. You're working on something quite special for that. Cash in on that, right? Is that what you're up to?
I am, and it's.
I mean, to pay due homage to
it. Is it a Peter Duncan Q&A?
It is.
Spare
me the madness!
In 4K. In 4K, nice. No, I'm working on the first and only official making of Flash Gordon book. In fact, I delivered the first draft this Friday to Titan Books, and the last draft first week of March. So it's been quite frantic for the last year. It's taken me a year to get this project together. It's with King Features, the rights holder for Flash Gordon. And I'm working with Studio Canal, who are the owners now of the Flash Gordon film. And they're working on a new 4K scan, which will be released in May-June time.
Are you getting like a couple of pounds every time you say 4K, John? Because I'm detecting, there's a bit of a theme.
He's trying
here.
To bump it up to 8K.
He really likes 4K. Yeah, give me 8K
or
give me
death.
Just
tell him that we've all got 5K machines.
16K.
Really
Well, I think the really significant thing about it is that there's lots of films from when Ray was making Jason and Clash and so on that were pushed through the Oscars corridor by the studios that were considered to be main pictures that have sat on the shelf and haven't even been scanned for Blu-ray. So it's almost a badge of status, it's an award to say we're taking this library release and we're going to do something special and we're going to do this UHD.
Right, so John, it is time now for your Vintage Geek Challenge. Three cheeky questions about your chosen subject, Flash Gordon. Are you ready?
I am.
Excellent. That actually wasn't the first question, but it was a question. So far, the record is one out of three. Can you beat one out of three?
But I won that, and I deserved it.
Honestly, the second question was rubbish. The way that I look at it, it's terrible. But still, I can't give it. It just wouldn't be fair to John.
We live and learn.
Yeah. But I'm all about prizes, so what incentivises me here? Have I got another book?
Okay, question one.
an extra 2K.
Question one. No one dies in the palace without what?
Without Ming's approval. Without permission from the emperor himself.
What do we say? The direct quote is a command from the emperor. Do we get that to him?
He's answered the question. You didn't ask for a quote. I think, even though it works against me.
I'm just checking. Okay, 4K. That's fine. Okay. Referring to the production problems that plagued the film, who described Flash Gordon as the only improvised $27 million movie ever made?
Oh, the brilliant Mike Hodges, who's written the foreword for my new book.
This boy's
excellent.
Doing well.
Like you got him to write the foreword.
Yes, indeed.
Is the book in 4K? Oh.
It is.
Oh, brilliant.
That's awesome.
Okay, question number three. For three out of three and the grand prize, Ming the Merciless says that when he destroys a planet, he calls upon the great god Daizan. Daizan is Japanese for what?
Destroyer?
No.
Hoover?
That's a good guess.
Hold
Hoover.
On. Do this sound? I got this sound every 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
Jeremy Daizan?
That's harsh.
God of...
It's great cruelty.
Oh. My thesaurus would say the same thing.
Yeah.
So, yes, well, the movie, that's very good. 2 out of 3, still ahead of other people.
Yeah, but it was only 3 questions on one movie. I had to deal with 12 from Stanley Kubrick.
You were the one that said Stanley Kubrick. You could have made it about, could have said, I want it about me. you have to think ahead. The movie was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, right? He and Sam Jones really... Is it true they really hated each other?
I wouldn't say that they hated, but there was lots of problems on the film. This book is for the first time speaking to all the participants. And in the case of the great Dino De Laurentiis, of whom I'm an enormous fan and admirer, I've managed to speak to Martha De Laurentiis, his wife. I've spoken to all of the production personnel that, who are still with us, and some who aren't have lent me their last interviews from family and friends. So Dino fell out with Sam because Sam walked off the picture before they finished it. So there was lots of big disputes. Sam got into fights during filming.
He was dubbed as well, right? Is that true?
He was looped in by other actors in certain scenes because they had to, because they didn't have Sam for it.
Right.
But most frustratingly, and I think this is where everyone agrees, including Sam, it was a big mistake. When they were doing all of the soft PR on couches, like Good Morning America and so on, and Breakfast News, had it been here at the time, they were sending Max von Sydow, who was a brilliant actor but quite dry person to speak to, when, of course, you want to see Flash from Flash Gordon and Dale Arden and so on. So he wasn't available for all of those tours. And I think that's what helped the film not punch through in America. Whereas in Europe and in Asia, it did extremely well. In the US, it wasn't a great start. But a little interesting fact that even most of the people didn't know on the production, of which the book is full of, Dino tried to buy Pinewood Studios because he was going to make three Flash Gordons back to back.
Oh, God, I would have loved that.
I would have loved that. Exactly.
A little bit of trivia. I actually met Dino De Laurentiis. I went to his house and Martha was there. And it was I was working at Universal Studios at the time and doing distribution deals on the movie Hannibal. And a lot of distributors came in and were asking for lots and lots of money. So I sold Japan and that went for $14 million alone. And when people went into negotiation, they said, well, look, you've got Anthony Hopkins, but you don't have Jodie Foster. And Dino said, and I'm sorry, I'm going to do a crude, hopefully not an offensive Italian impression, but he said, the movies are not called a Clarice. The movies are called the Hannibal. And
that was pretty offensive.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I really so sorry.
That
was approved by Dino.
I love Super Mario. It's amazing. It's a me, Dino.
Well, John, thank you so much for coming in. And John's book, Ray Harryhausen, The Lost Movie, is available to buy everywhere. All good bookshops, most bad bookshops, probably just everywhere.
Everywhere. And today it's been nominated for a Rondo Award. So
congratulations. Right. So let's listen to some more music. We have The Ecstasy of Gold from The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, Ennio Morricone.
Thank you.
God, another amazing track there. Let's just listen to this again because I really love it.
Tuesday Takeover with Marshall Julius on FUBAR Radio.
Okay, so earlier we kind of touched on Kubrick only winning the special effects Oscar. And I did a bit of research on directors, great directors who never won a Best Director Oscar. And, you know, Kubrick's not alone. Hitchcock never won.
Crime.
Sidney Lumet never won.
Crime.
Howard Hawks, Sergio Leone. From the art house set, you've got Akira Kurosawa, Goddard, Bergman. You know, do you think that the Oscars actually gets it wrong more than it gets it right?
I think that for the... I'm sorry, Fraser, if I interrupt you. I think that the Oscars and BAFTA and all of these awards serve a great purpose, and that is that they get people talking about the movies. And sometimes that can be in hot, you know, frantic debate. You know, I love this one, I hate this one. Whatever encourages people to go and see movies, go to the cinema, which is even better, that's fantastic. But, you know, ultimately, what's the success of a movie and of a director? And I think it's the legacy of how long their work is remembered for. So if you go year on year and see the movies that the best of Hitchcock and look at the other movies that came out at that time, well, you work out which ones are being talked about now and which have been long since forgotten. That's the real victory, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a sign of accomplishment. You've got to remember the voting. The people that are voting are not necessarily the best people to judge.
Well, hang on there. I did vote for the BAFTAs, so...
Well, that's a perfect example.
We are.
That's
really
a perfect example.
So I'm definitely not going to take them seriously
but
now.
It's such a wide pool of people that it's almost impossible to find a consensus, right? I mean, it's
very difficult, and the reasons why people vote and how they vote at a certain time as a snapshot, I think it is true that you tend to remember the movies you most recently saw, and so if you're like 1917 and you're the last movie people saw, you're going to get more votes if it's a good film.
Yeah.
It's just the way it works.
I just voted in the Golden Raspberries.
And how did you?
He voted for himself.
I was trying to get myself on stage.
the ultimate consummate publicist.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's say hello to our next guest live via the modern wonder of Telefonica. It's comedian, writer and actor Dave Johns. Hello, Dave.
Hello, live from the tune.
How are you doing, Dave?
I'm great. I'm live from the tune. I've just went for a big, long walk along the coastline today and I just rushed back to get back for you on this fabulous show.
Well,
I'm
thank
very
you.
Very well, Marshall. Nice to hear your lovely dulcet tones. And I must say, you've got beautiful soft skin.
I do. I do. I smell delicious too.
You do. You do smell.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Can you just mention that, please? We talked about this, all right? Let's just.
Okay. Yes, let's not talk about that.
Okay,
so how
Dave.
Are you? How's it going?
It's going very well. I got lots of searing questions for you, things that really get into the meat and the gristle of your
life. Find out who I am.
Yes. Everyone knows. Okay, here we go. First question. Dave, you have enjoyed a long and successful career in stand-up comedy. You have appeared as a guest on the likes of Nevermind the Buzzcocks and 8 out of 10 Cats. At the age of 60, you seized movie stardom with the leading role in I, Daniel Blake, and have since carved out a career as a movie star. But now you're here talking to me. What went wrong?
What went wrong?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is everything's got to come to an end, hasn't it? Everything's got to come to an end. And what better my end than talking in shite to you all day?
It's true. Well, you just had to accept it, really, I suppose.
I did. No, it's been great. It's been great. As you know, I'm having a ball, you know. It's 63 years of age, you know. At 60, you know, to get to make films, it's a hoot. It's a complete hoot. And I've got a... Here's a little bit of an excuse for you. In March, I'm playing a drag queen in the next film.
So is that autobiographical then?
No. I just think it's quite an interesting little part, and I've always wanted to get an excuse to get, you know, dressed up. And a friend of mine who was in Everybody Loves Jamie says the hardest thing is to, he says, get the heels on quickly. You know, get used to wearing heels because of the most difficult thing. So since I've got the part, I've been walking around in 7-inch heels. I think they're a bit big for me. I should have got smaller ones and just built up. So I've got...
Don't they sink into the mud when you're going for a bit of a hike?
What?
Don't they sink into the mud?
I've got hiking heels. I've got hiking high heels.
Dave, is there any truth to the rumours, and there have been a lot of them this week, that you're the next James Bond?
Oh, wouldn't that be great, a Geordie James Bond?
No, I would love to see that. You'd have to be better than Daniel Craig.
Yeah,
or Gollum, as I call him.
I'll knock your block off, Blofeld.
That is the next James Bond quote. We've had them all, you know, do you expect me to talk? But no, I'm going to knock your block off, Blofeld. That's genius. I want a T-shirt with that on.
I've got to say, it's better when Dave said it.
And I'll be stationed in it, so my lair would be an old abandoned mine.
Oh, I love it.
And in drag.
I have robot pit ponies.
In drag, you could also play Miss Moneypenny.
Yeah,
you could double up.
Well, that's it, yeah.
Just play all the roles.
Half a tuxedo, half a dress on with a wig on one side.
You just change angles.
Both of them, yeah.
Twice the paycheck as well. That's great.
Yeah,
Dave. I remember Dave when we first met at the Critics Circle Awards, the one in which I didn't give you the award for best actor. Yes, you were. I had to give it to Andrew Garfield instead, and you told my wife not to have sex with me for a whole year. So thank you for that.
Andrew Garfield wouldn't have sex with you.
No, not for a whole year.
Oh, sorry, I misheard.
When we first met, I remember my wife. She said that I'd been very kind of affected. Honestly, Daniel Blake. It's a very sad film. It makes you angry and sad. Not sleepy, but angry and sad. And my wife said that I wanted to give you a hug, and you know, we embraced, it was a magic moment, wasn't it?
Yeah. Was that the same awards when? Because I was at one awards when.
Doesn't remember.
I do remember. Okay. Yeah, no, but I was at Lord's that time. But is that the one where when Hugh Grant won something as well? Because he came up to me after he'd won the award. He said, "You should have won Best Actor," and I said to him, "Well, give us it then."
Yeah. or a knock your block off.
It was kind of annoying that he won for Paddington 2.
And because I had the Geordie accent, he probably thought, he's going to take this off us.
he quickly got in a cab and went home.
To a fight in the toilet.
I remember that very well, Marshall.
So what I'm wondering is, kind of funny is your default setting, and you hadn't really acted, in that capacity before. How is it Ken Loach came to pick someone whose stock in trade is, being silly and taking the piss?
I think Ken likes working with comedians, and the reason why he likes working with comedians is because he says we're good at communicating. And, because what he means is that we go on stage in front of, hundreds of strangers, and we have to try and make each one of those people who are in the audience feel as though you're talking to them and you're their best mate. And I think that's what he meant by that, is that, and I just got it through a friend of mine said, text Kayleen Crawford, who was the casting director, and I did, and it all came about. I think I'll tell you before, Kayleen showed me the text after I'd been to the when it won the BAFTA, and she said, "I've still got your text," and I read it back, and it said, "Hi, my name's Dave Johns. I'm a 59-year-old stand-up comic. I hear Ken Loach is looking for a bloke to be in his new film. I'd be up for that." And she said, "Ken pissed himself laughing," and then basically got me in for casting. I just did an audition, I did a couple of auditions and got the part. So it was unbelievable, really.
And you had a really wild ride with it after it came out. It was like, the critics loved it. You travelled the world promoting it, didn't you?
Oh, God, it was crazy, man. I mean, we went to Cannes, we went to, Isabelle Huppert. I met her 5 times on red carpets, and she kept coming over to me and going, "Oh, Lord, David," and people got me, "How do you know Isabelle Huppert?" And I was going, "We've been known mates for years. She used to be a welder." But no, I got on really. Yeah, it was crazy. Went to all these festivals, went to all these, I had vendors come over and give us a big cuddle in the European Film Awards. It was just crazy, just all this mad thing for a year. It was bonkers, and then the BAFTAs and I haven't won a BAFTA for ages.
I know, doesn't it strike you as wrong? All the awards, I'm noticing they have a severe lack of Dave Johns. That, I think I'm just losing interest in them.
I think the things that I've done after Daniel Blake have been very feel good, and like Fisherman's Friends, you know, it did really well. It did great at the box office, and they're making Fisherman's Friends too. But I don't think it was going to win anything at Cannes or at the BAFTAs. But then again, you know, there's films that win awards, and there's films that are very successful and don't win awards, and you know, the audiences love them. You know, I think that's the way it is. I think I came in on my first film and won all those awards. I think I've set the benchmark a bit high.
What about your next film? Because I know that that's coming out in September. I think, is it 23 Walks?
Yeah, with Alison Steadman, which was a two-hand. That's about two people in their 60s who meet on 23 Dog Walks, and we filmed it over a year. So we've got like the seasons. We've got, you know, autumn, summer, and spring, and winter. And so we filmed it 2-week blocks, and it's about these two people who meet on a dog, walking their dogs, and it's about their relationship. And yeah, it was fabulous with Alison Steadman. What a laugh she is. We had such a heat, you know. And basically, I saw the screen a couple of weeks ago. And I still can't get used to watching myself on screen, but it's like, because I'm in this film more than in Daniel Blake. It was just all the time, it was just me and her. And I was going, this is going to rest every scene. And when it's every scene, you don't get any sort of rest to go, oh, well, you know, until I come up again. So that was quite weird to see yourself in every single scene in the film.
Are you much of a dog person, Dave?
No, I'm not a dog person at all. So I should win a BAFTA because I look like I love that dog.
The performance of a lifetime.
And my missus says she came and saw it as well, the screen, and she said it looked like you were really in love with that dog. It's the same with when I'm like.
Was she worried?
Well, no. I just think that, you know, it does look like. No, I'm not a dog lover at all. I don't hate dogs. I just don't have any affinity to them because I've never had one, you know.
You should probably not say things like that when you're doing the publicity. Yeah. I don't hate dogs.
Newspaper tomorrow. Dog-hating actor. Dog-acting BAFTA winner.
I know, but it's like if you're doing like Star Wars, I don't go, oh, have you ever been in space before? No. I've never fought a Dalek. I mean, you know, it's just fascinating.
No, you're right. I love dogs, but I couldn't finish the whole one.
Yeah.
I don't kick dogs. I'm not cruel at dogs. I just don't have any sort of either way, you know.
Would you cross the road to stop someone else kicking a dog, though?
Yeah, I would. I would always save an animal.
Would you fight a Dalek in space to stop a dog getting hurt?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I'd do all that.
We've saved it, guys.
Okay, I think we pulled
I'm
it
just
back.
Listening to this. I have nothing to add.
Get the PR team off it. We're good.
Okay, so Dave, in the wrestling movie you made a few years back, Walk Like a Panther, you squeezed into some extremely skimpy and revealing spandex outfits to toss your opponents around the ring. In 23 Walks, I understand you filmed your first sex scene. I was wondering if you feel the pressure to show more flesh as you get older.
Honestly, mate, I'll tell you this, right? We did this sex scene in
23 Walks.
And the shag.
And they said to me, you've got to wear like a modesty pouch. And I went, oh, all right, you know, you'd be naked, but you've got this modesty pouch on. So I put it on, and me and Alison and that were standing in on the set. We both had bathrobes on and that, and I'm. I'm not right. I go, this is really, really uncomfortable. And I go, what? And they're all setting up the shot. And the costume says, what's wrong? I go, it's really uncomfortable. This is. She says, but it's sort of like industry standard. I went, well, you know, I am a Geordie, you know. And she went, she said, come here, let's have a look. And I thought, oh, I'll just show them. So I opened my dressing gown. She goes, you've got it on back to front. And each one of my balls was hanging out each side of the thing. And it was like Dumbo. It was like Dumbo's face. And your balls were like the ears.
And why wasn't that scene in the movie?
That's what I an elephant can fly.
No, that sounds amazing.
Well, what happened was the director had to stand everybody down to her. He was like, they're laughing their heads off in the foot. And she's going, come on, everybody get the focus pull. I was going, I've got to leave. She goes, Dumbo was my favourite film as a kid.
You've ruined it. Well, I think that's one for the Me Too movement. Yeah. Dave Johnson shows his veg.
So that was my sort of sex scene, but it was all tastefully done. You know, we are pensioners.
Sounds like it.
It does. It sounds.
The sex scene wasn't like you see them on Game of Thrones. You know, it wasn't all that. You know, yeah. It was very tastefully done.
Potpourri, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Justice.
So, Dave, you're going to start shooting, like you said, your first sequel soon, Fisherman's Friends. Can we expect full frontal nudity in that one, or perhaps hardcore sexual content?
Will you show your fisherman friend?
Will you show your
fisherman's friend? Will you show your fisherman's friend?
I'm getting this thing on the pyramid stage at Glastonbury. How cool is that?
That's cool.
That is amazing.
Yeah. Because the storyline is that it ends up in Glastonbury. It's called Fisherman's Friends, The Road to Glastonbury. So I'm very looking forward to that because we're going to be filming it down in Port Isaac again, and the cast are such good fun. I mean, the last one we did, we just had such a laugh. We were we've got to make a film as well. It was such fun. I mean, I've been very lucky that all the films I've done, I've worked with Stevie Graham, and he's a fantastic actor. He was great in The Irishman. I've worked with James Purefoy and Tuppence Middleton and Davey Heyman and Alison Steadman and all the people I've worked with. Have been really, really cool. I've had such a good time, and they've all, you know, when I'm like a newcomer, really. I mean, I've had to learn sort of on sort of like, you know, just on the job about filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Because Ken works much different than anybody else. He's like, you know, it's a very small crew, and it's very sort of top of the actor. But when you go on these big commercial shoots, it's like it's up. I've got to tell you a story. I just did a small bonus episode. You do this part in the new remake of Live Spirit, you know, that they've done, you know?
Oh, yes.
And which is coming out this year, and they said, look, they said, we'd really love you to do it. They said, it's not a massive big part, you're just playing the gardener. I went, oh, yeah, I'll do this a couple of days. So on the first day's shoot, we went down there, and you know Isla Fisher?
Sasha Baron Cohen, married, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, famous in her own right, obviously. But, yeah.
She's playing the lead, the wife, and Leslie Mann's playing Elvira. And it was the first day of the shoot, so basically it was the first day we had the first scene. So all the crew were new, everybody was set up, and we did this shot. And I'd got Tom Hardy's boots and Peaky Blinders, because when I got them on, they had Tom Hardy's name, and she was all in the costume. Oh, he wore these in Peaky Blinders. So I had Tom Hardy's boots on, so I thought, this is pretty cool. So we sent the shot, and I goes, and she goes, he's got Tom Hardy's boots on. I goes, yeah, I have, I do. So I can't be responsible for any acting choices I make in the shot. And so this was the first shot of the film, and I went, okay, turning over, in action. And I just started, like, jumping up and down, and I ran across the field, and all I come for and I was shouting, it's not me, it's Tom Hardy. He's begging us to do it.
You're possessed.
And you can see the yellow fish going, what's he doing? And I had to cut, and I came back, and it was just a nice way of sort of calming everybody down on the first shoot. So I'm basically this sort of, I'm learning on the job, you know. I mean, I wouldn't have done that if it had been the last day of the shoot and we're running out of light. I don't think they would have laughed then.
Okay, Dave, are you ready now to take your Vintage Geek Trivia Challenge? Hit you with three quiz questions on your chosen subject, Vintage Kids Television.
Oh, God. Okay, come on then.
Okay, you could totally be cheating now because you're not in the studio, so it's like, quickly go just on Google. Google. Okay, right.
No, I would never cheat. I've never cheated.
So, question one. It took the combined talents of Mitzi, Little Bit, and Mr. Gipper to play which character in their own hit adventure show from 1964 to 1967?
Is this American?
Yes. No, is it? Yes, probably. I don't know. I don't think... Oh, did they film it?
You're the quiz master.
Names again?
Mitzi, Little Bit, and Mr. Gipper. I think it was American.
Oh, God.
Gipper. That's kind of a bit of a clue there.
Gipper. Is it Mr. Ed?
No, it's Flipper. It's Flipper.
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 All right. Oh, God.
Okay, that was... Okay, hold on. So I pressed that twice by mistake. I didn't mean to rub it in. Apparently, I learned that the dolphin trainer would sometimes run an extension cord down to the seaquarium so that the dolphins who acted in the show could actually watch it when it was broadcast.
But so we knew what to do.
Sort of dangerous to run electrical cord. Yeah. You know,
it's never worked out for me when I put a television in the bath.
Did have a couple of dolphins in Flipper.
Three dolphins all playing Flipper.
Okay.
Well. I can't even say that the questions in my book are easier than this. Right, question number two. Name any... okay, this is a British one. Name any three kids' shows created by Small Films, Oliver Postgate and Peter Fermin. Now it's Dave's question.
Ivor the Engine.
Ivor the Engine.
Noggin the Nog.
Noggin the Nog.
And Bagpuss.
Bagpuss.
Yay.
Gets two yeses. We would have also accepted The Mermaid's Pearls.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but I never saw that one.
No, I just got a list of them.
No one
there.
Did.
No one saw that. okay, question number three. What is the name of the robot in Gerry Anderson's last black and white Super Mario Nation show, Fireball XL5?
Going home, Robbie the robot, going home.
That's very good. It's Robert.
I wish I was a spaceman.
The fastest guy alive.
I'd fly around
the universe in Fireball XL5. We're out of space together.
Brilliant, man.
Oh, we're going to stop there. Okay, I was ready.
So, can I just check here? You're going to give him Robbie the Robot, which is from Forbidden Planet, and not take a point away.
Yeah.
Oh, that really hurts. That really hurts.
Yeah. Look, Dave's...
What's the name of the monkey?
Zuni the Loopy Lazoon. He wasn't a monkey. He was an alien.
The monkey, yeah, you're getting mixed up with Supercar, because Mitch the monkey was in Supercar.
Well, he looked like a monkey, didn't he?
He did look super, like a monkey.
Like E.T., he looked super diseased. Didn't you always think that E.T. had some horrible disease?
Like he had mange.
There's no way I would touch that.
Like his fur is
There's no
off.
Way I'd let him put his glowing finger on me.
Do you know what Zuni's catchphrase was?
What I should have done was,
but
that was all right, 2 out of 3.
That's very good.
Why
was E.T.'s
finger so red?
What?
Yeah. We're just talking about E.T.'s finger.
Yeah, we've lost him.
Dave, do you remember the second time that I met you, I got super drunk and I kept calling your film I, Daniel Craig, and I was too drunk to notice and you kept giggling and I didn't realise until I sobered up what I did, but you were very kind about that, and I was just wondering, I know that you you kind of enjoy sort of taking the piss out of celebrities yourself, and you had kind of an amusing encounter with Steven Spielberg in a lift, didn't you?
No, it wasn't in a lift, it was in the middle of the hotel. I got introduced to him. He said to me, congratulations on your film, I, Daniel Blake. It's terrific. So I said to him, I didn't know what to say. I said to him, how's the DFG going? And he went, yeah, it's going really well. We're really pleased about it. And I said afterwards, I said, so, you know, because Ken Loach couldn't make a film like the DFG. And he went, I guess not. Ken's more political. And I went, no, he'd want a real giant in it. And he looked at us and I went, and you can't get them. And I said, I mean, we used to have them years ago in the villages, but we had to get rid of them because they were stealing all the farm animals.
And all the good parts.
Yeah, you see people going, what? Are you for real? Are you just an idiot? So I think he thought I was an idiot rather than anything else, you know?
Or he believed you, and now he thinks giants are real. You never know. You might have influenced him.
Yeah.
Maybe you sparked a whole, interesting sequel.
What I said was, you can't get him. And then I went, well, of course you'd know that, wouldn't you? Because you probably tried for agents before you got Mark Rylance.
Well, actually, Mark Rylance is a giant, and they can only reduce him in size with CGI to fit in his films.
He's a giant.
That's absolutely true. Him down.
Yeah, absolutely.
His big fingers.
So, Dave, what film, if you could do anything?
I've got a great story. Mark Rylance came up to Ken Loach, and he said, and this is how such a great sense of humour Ken Loach is. He says to Ken Loach, he goes, last month, Ken, Daniel Day-Lewis and me, Daniel came over to my house and we watched all your films back to back. And Ken went, you don't want to kill yourself? can you imagine having them two watching your acting? Can you imagine them? Imagine the competition, you fly on the wall with them two, Mark Rylance in there and Daniel Day-Lewis.
No, I think I'd be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Dave, thank you so much for taking time out of your film star schedule to chat with us.
Cool,
really appreciate
it. Couldn't have come down. We'll have to meet up and have a beer one day, mate.
That would be amazing. We love that.
Yeah, okay. I'll get in touch.
So right now we're going to listen to John Barry's super cool spy theme from 1969's on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Ah,
cool.
So, Fraser, you were telling us a really inappropriate story about toilets and urinals. Why don't you share it with everyone?
We were talking about the Critics Circle Award earlier. We're both at the awards, you and I, and we didn't know each other then, so we're both at the same awards. Steve McQueen, the director, had won for 12 Years a Slave, I think Best Director. And
The one that drove around the cars in San Francisco in Bullet?
No.
Right, okay.
No.
Just to clarify that.
The cooler one.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm standing at the urinals in this glorious, in our tuxedos. Steve McQueen's next to me, the director.
Are you there a lot?
I am there a lot. Just hanging out, see who I can see. I've had a few drinks. I happen to be standing in the same urinal.
In the urinal? You're having drinks in the urinal?
The old cakes soak it all up. It's great. So I'm standing there. I look at Steve McQueen. He's holding his award. I turn to him. I look down at his award and obviously his cock at the same time by mistake and say, "That's very impressive." He looked at me like he wanted to punch me square in the jaw, zipped up and ran away really fast. So that's my Steve McQueen award-winning story.
Did you really announce it like you were doing a trailer voice?
I genuinely...
That's
in a world
impressive.
Where Steve McQueen goes to the toilet.
It was a time of war. Steve McQueen had won an award. It's like I'm watching a trailer in the cinema. It's amazing.
That's very impressive.
Mm. So you've upset quite a lot of famous people over the years.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can tell all those stories. I'm very outspoken.
See, whereas I'm here to make famous people happy. That's what I do. Just different roles, different purpose.
No, I'm only a producer just to annoy famous people. That's the only reason I got into it. Just to put them in their place, basically.
So many people expect kind of easy questions. I remember it was on the junket for Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed. You know,
that's the best one in the trilogy of two films.
Yeah. Yes, it was. So Sarah Michelle Gellar, and she's telling a story about when she was shooting The Grudge, the first, you know, bad Grudge remake. And she said, and we went out after the... I'm not going to do the voice. I'm not like John.
Do
I can't
it,
just
do it.
I'm not going to do it. Okay. So she said she went up to town with her friends. They were shooting in Tokyo, I think, and they found this very exclusive restaurant, and they were serving blowfish that, you know, you have to cut super carefully. And she said, and so I had a plate. It was so delicious. And, you know, I wasn't poisoned, so I like had another dish. And then I looked and I saw that it was like $200 a plate. And I thought, and I said, but look, I saw you got paid like $2 million for Scooby-Doo 2. Are you really worried about a few hundred dollars? Yeah. And she really was not impressed.
Wow.
You know, they don't like talking about
it. And have you kept up that relationship in the years since?
And, yes. where is she now?
Yes, she continues to not reply to any of my
letters. Well, Freddie Prinze, her husband's not short of a few bob either, Freddie Prinze Jr. He inherited Freddie Prinze Sr.'s vast wealth.
Yeah, I did not know that. Did you know that?
Well, yeah.
He played Fred in Scooby-Doo.
He was Chico and the Man, which was a classic TV series of the 1970s.
And quite a prolific producer as well. I think Freddie Prinze Sr. went on to a lot of producing. Anyway, she could afford a £200. I'm gonna Instagram her right now and say, look, you can afford a £200 plate of fish. It's fine.
You really can. You really can. Yeah. I mean, like, have four plates. Have five plates.
Yeah.
You know,
buy one just to throw it in the bin.
Yes, in front of
just
people.
Just because I can. I'm Sarah Michelle Gellar.
So there was another time. You remember when the Simpsons came to London years ago? I mean, it was
they're
like
fictional.
The,
you know that, right?
No, but the Simpsons cast came and they did some live readings. It was just like 5 years.
Well, I remember I was with you and we met Dan Castellaneta at the opening of the Cato Gallery in Hampstead.
Oh yes,
and it was a life changing experience for the two of us because we got him to say, and this is going to be a really bad impression, but we got him to say, "Don't enter my life."
Yeah, over and over and over.
Why did he do it as Yoda?
I don't know.
Weird.
But it was just magical. It was like Homer was right there in front of us.
We like drove him mad. I remember. I know that he doesn't do impressions anymore of Homer in public, and I think that's because of us.
We probably
ruined it for everybody.
I saw Matt. I'm not going to even try his surname.
Groening.
So I was at Comic Con a couple of years ago, and he's just standing by the Boingo comics booth, the Simpsons comic booth, and no one's paying a blind bit of attention to him. So he ended up chatting to me for like 35 minutes. We had a photo taken and nobody knew who he was. And that just really upset me.
That's crazy.
Standing at the booth.
I met him at this read-through event and I got tickets for it. I was very excited to have these tickets. And I went up to him and I said, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you very much. And, you know, I was going on and on. And then I said, you know, I would have done anything for these tickets. I would have traded my grandmother's kidneys. And I said, unfortunately, she's dead, but I would have had to, you know, I would have dug her up. And I felt like I was like, had a total out-of-body experience. And I just really couldn't stop. Kind of a bit like now. And his gaze went away from my eyes, looking over my shoulder, and he kind of did this, I don't know, this thing with his face.
It's called ignoring you.
Yeah, whatever. His assistant came out and said, Matt, we got to go and do the thing now. And he said, oh, okay. So he said goodbye and rushed away. So the next day, I managed to get tickets for the second day, and I got to him at the after party to apologize. And again, I've cornered him, and I'm apologizing for the grandmother's kidney story by repeating the grandmother's kidney story. And again, he's looking over my shoulder and his eyes go wide, and the same assistant comes up and says, Matt, you know, there's a thing there. So
I hope you called her out for it. I hope you said, no, you said that yesterday. That's not
no. I realized that I should probably never ever speak to Matt Groening again. You know, I'm not like easily starstruck, but
time's
the Simpsons
charm.
Man,
you gotta go and face up to it. You gotta go and meet him and interest him.
He'll just be hanging out at the booth at San Diego. Just go see him, he'll be fine. Just pop along, he'll just be there.
So let's hope we won't be too starstruck when our next guest, Patrick Savage, comes in. Let's just have a little bit more music and we'll see Patrick after that. Thank you.
Radio presents
Callum McSwiggan,
the most beautiful person in existence. It's Glyn Fussell.
Hello, Callum.
I once invited a guy over, and I specifically invited him over for sex. I was very honest and upfront about why I was inviting him over.
Which is political, it's very core.
Turned out he was a Tory, and he came over and literally sat on my bed and talked about politics. There was no sex, and then he left, and I was like, I don't understand what's happened. I feel like I've been tricked.
that's what the Tories do. Anything for a vote. Fucking vote.
Yeah, don't let them trick you on Grindr.
Poison Grindr. I mean, that's...
Harriet Rose.
Will.i.am is joining us on Foobar Radio right now.
There's things that I've done before that I didn't release. Like a piece of content that I did with Miley Cyrus that was heavy, and we decided not to put it out.
What do you do with that kind of stuff? Do you hold it in a bank, like, I might put this out one day, or is it like, never again, put it away, we won't see this again?
For the Miley Cyrus one, we got rid of it. It was just too heavy.
You just know, though, don't you?
This one in particular, the Black Eyed Peas one, I know in my heart that it has to come out.
Joey Page.
I'm very excited to welcome Highly Suspect into the studio.
Yeah.
Hey,
what's up? Yeah, we have what we like to call pre-show poops. It's when you get really juiced up and then all of a sudden you have to poop right before the show.
Is that on your rider? We must have four cubicles available.
We have pre-show. Four toilets backstage.
Getting excited for the show definitely gets you pumped.
You're listening to Foobar Radio.
Foobar Radio.
You're listening to Foobar Radio.
Tuesday Takeover with Marshall Julius on Foobar Radio.
And Patrick Savage is here. Hello, Patrick.
Marshall, hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, How are you doing?
I'm doing absolutely fine. It's great to be here.
Now, I understand that you are going to play your violin. You're going to play some tunes for us. We're going to see if we can guess what the tunes are. And you would like to do it now while your violin is warm.
I'm going to do it now. My idea was that you were going to try and stop me as soon as you guess what it is. I'm going to play little
the theme from Star Wars.
Little filmy bits. No, that's wrong. Little excerpts. The thing is about solo violin. Nobody likes solo violin. Solo violin on the radio is probably a little bit like pulling teeth.
No.
So I think you'd be doing everyone a favor if you can stop me as soon as you can. I'm going to play three little things, and I've got a follow-up question. Test your nerdiness.
Okay, so whoever guesses it has the follow-up question. Should we do that?
Okay, we can do it that way.
All right.
So I need a film or a composer.
Film or a composer, okay.
Double points if you get both. But this one's going to be easy.
Wow, this sounds really complicated.
Give me a second. I'll set up.
Okay.
Jaws.
Do we like make a noise if we've got the answer?
You go.
You've got the machine, Marshall. That's cheating.
That's right.
You have to shout out.
I can actually get it wrong, and I can say, "Oh, it's that guy Dave from the movie whatever."
See? I love whatever.
But if I did something like that, is that?
No. I.
Hey, the violin's getting cold.
Yeah, it's my Tuesday takeover.
I'm very confused.
You're my co-host, Monkey, and don't forget it.
You're going to get this in about 1 second anyway. Okay. Oh, come on.
Is it Fiddler on the Roof?
It is Fiddler on the Roof.
I was going to say, so here's the problem. Okay. Everything sounds like Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, it does.
So I'm like, is
that
it Fiddler?
Or Schindler's List?
Is
the next one Schindler's List?
Schindler on the Roof.
Do you know in America, I only found this out yesterday doing some research, that was the number one film in 1971. That was the biggest box office hit of
that
year.
I did know that. I didn't make an album.
I knew that. I could tell you. Okay.
And that is why you're a co-host and not the main host.
Here's my follow-up question.
That's for me then. It's for me.
All right. So John Williams won his first Oscar for that film. It wasn't for original score. For best scoring adaptation and original song score. Hmm. So what film did he actually earn his best original music?
It's my question.
Oh, sorry,
say E.T. Was it E.T.?
It was not E.T.
Oh, okay, you go.
Schindler's List?
Those he did win, but the first.
The first one?
The first one.
Fraser gets a go.
have no idea.
Fraser's got no idea.
Can you give us a clue, like the year?
Can you give us a clue? Can you give us the name
because
of the film?
Because John Williams did every film in the 70s.
I'll tell you what, it was Jaws.
Huh. Ah, that's not really that's a not clue, really technically. Yeah.
Was it Jaws?
It was Jaws.
Hey, excuse me. I got my point. Patrick, do you do requests? Can you play the Jaws theme on the violin?
Well, Jaws doesn't really have a theme.
It's two notes, right?
But how did he... Jaws!
Yes.
That's amazing.
Thank Jaws you. On the roof.
Thank you, Patrick.
That was completely
thank
you. From
you just
my
said
mind.
You can't do it on the violin, and then you did it on the violin.
Yeah. See, that's what we're off. Here for, Patrick, to push you. To push you. You're going to do things on the show you never realised you could do.
I appreciate that. I'm going to be a bigger person afterwards. So the next one is Easy 2.
Easy 2? I suppose so I did get the first one right.
You did get it right.
I did.
You know, eventually. Yeah. Okay.
Young Frankenstein.
It is indeed Young Frankenstein.
Wow. I should have let him play, but
really
I didn't want anyone
today,
else to
Marshall.
Win.
Yeah, it was that close. Is there a follow-up question as well?
There is a follow-up question.
Peter Boyle.
Oh, by the
Mel
way.
Mel Brooks. No, I should give you a chance.
Did you know that is also the score for the dramatic chipmunk meme?
Huh.
You know when you know the little chipmunk that turns around and looks shocked?
Yeah.
That music is from The Young Frankenstein by John Morris. So that...
Does he get paid every time he's played?
Which one came first?
What's a meme?
No, I'm
okay, here it is. So, what David Lynch film, also produced by an uncredited Mel Brooks?
Elephant Man.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
Are you going to play it, though? Oh, is that the question?
That was the question.
Oh, okay. So.
Okay. Right. So,
what do I win?
Well, that's you know, you didn't even let him finish his question.
Can I throw a geeky question back at Patrick? In Young Frankenstein, who plays the blind man?
Oh boy, I know that. I know it, but I don't know with the microphone.
It was Gene Hackman.
There you go.
It was
correct.
His birthday the other day.
I know.
He's like 100 now.
Yeah,
90,
and retired.
Super retired. What a shame. Him and Sean Connery. You know, they could make an old codger movie.
We should get them
back
together.
Old people always make old codger films, and why can't they?
Because they're old as shit.
Sorry, that's my only thought. I hadn't really prepared anything.
No, that's. I apologise for getting that wrong. I should have known that.
So, Patrick, what else have you got
true.
For
hold
us?
Hold on. Don't get too comfortable. Okay.
Marshall, this whole buzzer control is just going to your head now. It's getting ridiculous.
Hackman
see what
Gene?
I mean?
Okay.
Here we go.
No, keep going. Sorry.
No, he doesn't know. Let's keep going.
I can
do
hear
you
it.
Know?
No, do you go on? No, keep going.
It's the Witches of Eastwick.
Oh. It is indeed the Witches of Eastwick.
The Witches of
I haven't
Eastwick.
Heard that for very about good. 20 or
no,
years.
No, and me neither. But it was great to hear it live here in the studio.
Yeah. I thought I had dementia. I'm actually quite pleased.
It's a great soundtrack. That who wrote that?
It was John Williams.
Was it?
It's always John Williams.
I told you,
every
film,
answer is John
Williams.
I always
John think
Williams.
John Williams is a bit hacky and he sounds like the
no,
same stuff.
No, he's a genius.
Like. But like that.
How dare you say that?
Oh, come on.
That's it, I'm turning your microphone down.
It's all the same.
If I knew which one of these buttons was yours, I'd... No, it's fine. You're entitled to your opinion.
So is there a bonus question?
There is a bonus question. Actually, you know what? At home, I came up with a fabulous bonus question that I thought was too hard.
No, go for it.
We like the hard ones.
Yeah.
Okay, the easy one was what instrument did Susan Sarandon play in the film?
Cherries.
Wait, what
cherries.
Film are we talking about? I'm completely lost.
Which of Eastwick?
Which is Eastwick?
I've got
cello.
No idea.
Yes. Which caught on fire?
Yes.
In quite a remarkable scene.
Yeah. I forgot that happened, but
I remember the cherries.
The cherries, yeah.
But that's not a musical instrument.
Sorry, was that the easy question?
That was the easy question.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the hard one then?
Yeah, come on then.
The other one was about John Williams.
Go on.
The other one was, do you know what temp score is? Of course you know what temp score is. Temp score is the music which editors edit to. So when my question was not about Witches of Eastwick, which I'm only sort of mildly interested in. It was about Star Wars.
We're definitely not going to get this.
there's a lot of other films that were temped into Star Wars that John Williams was listening to when he was composing. Any ideas about any one of those films that went into Star Wars?
Well, I'm going to make a guess, which is that a lot of the special effects and stuff were based on World War II sort of Spitfire action kind of stuff. So would it have been 633 Squadron or something like that?
Well, that's, I reckon that's close enough to get the Battle of Britain by Ron Goodwin.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Is that, is that actually the right answer, or is that in the ballpark?
No, that'll do.
Is that, well, that's are we going to give?
That'll do, Pig.
Yeah, yeah, there we go. I'm not getting anything for it, so what do I care?
You get a 4K TV.
But I just I prefer to give you one of those.
Yeah, but you can put me down, Marshall, but I
sense enough of that filth.
A degree of respect in the room for the way that I answered that. I can feel it.
Yeah, I honestly, that I wasn't great. Really listening.
Now, that was so in the spirit of it.
I kind of want to hear the whole suite from Witches of Eastwick now.
It is really good.
It's beautiful.
But we'll never know now. Because you just looked like you were about to guess it there, like, any second.
Yeah.
So I thought
it was
I
there. It was it there.
Was. It was out of the tip of your tongue.
I watched it so much as a kid, that film. Probably shouldn't have.
I'm quite grateful you stopped me there. It's a difficult piece.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Patrick.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
You are a respected concert violinist. You are a co-composer of and player on many a movie soundtrack. You're in the orchestra pit most nights on Hamilton in the West End. Clearly then, my first question has to be to you, who would win in a fight between Batman and Darth Vader? Would win in a fight between Batman and Darth Vader?
Darth Vader.
Do you think so?
How much planning does Batman have?
Now, Batman is always ready. I don't think anybody beats Batman, honestly.
But he could do the neck thing and then it's over.
Well, I would say...
Yeah, but then Batman would have like some sort of, you know, magnetised thing to like... to you know.
In my view, it would be Batman because Darth Vader's just pretend and Batman's real.
This is true.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
It was a trick question.
I hadn't thought of that. Well, no, I stand corrected. But it is Darth Vader because he can get you at a distance. I mean, Batman's got expensive toys, but he does have no powers.
And where does he get those wonderful toys, Patrick?
Where does he get those? But Batman is present day, and Star Wars is in a galaxy far, far away a long time ago. So technically, Darth Vader's dead anyway, so he'd just win by default.
But then Batman, he could beat Superman. If he could beat Superman, he could beat Darth Vader, because Superman would beat...
Batman versus Superman, did Batman win? Because I fell asleep about halfway through.
I didn't watch it, but in The Dark Knight Returns, he kind of
wins to a certain extent, then has a massive heart.
Well, yeah, okay. So that's generally how I'm going to get out of this conversation.
Was it a win? It's fall down.
No, that's a solid Darth Vader.
Yeah.
So I've heard you play many times. We've heard you play just now. And you're very good. Everybody agree? Very good, very good.
Yes.
Honestly, I couldn't do better myself. I heard Ron on the comb once, and he was sensational. But you, Patrick, you're something else. Was it very easy to get that good, or did it take like weeks of practice?
Weeks, many weeks. I studied for hours on YouTube. No,
they do have good tutorials there.
They do.
YouTube is amazing. I could spend my entire life learning skills which I'll never use.
So aside from the violin, what skills have you picked up from YouTube?
Yes. Oh, none. But I've learned. The resources are all there, and I've watched a lot of videos.
I learned pickling from YouTube. Pickling.
Actually, you know what? I actually learned pickling too.
We have so much in common.
I have pickled lemons from YouTube.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll get
you
a good.
You need to see a doctor.
That's like Reg Vaughn.
I learned how to play one song off of YouTube.
What on though?
On the piano.
On the piano?
I don't play it. To propose to my now wife, and then I totally forgot how to play the song after that.
What was the song?
It was Bob Dylan, You Belong to Me.
That's sweet.
That's a bit presumptuous, I think.
But I changed it to Will You Marry Me?
I'm sitting next to Fraser.
But then I totally forgot, but I learned it on YouTube. Because I can't read music, so I learned it by just copying the fingers.
Oh, you know, sitting next to you, I wouldn't have you for a romantic, but actually that's a really
Darling, you can
thing.
Have me anytime you want.
That is quite lovely. But how many times did you have to watch the video?
Oh, I lost count. Like, it was ridiculous. It was weeks and weeks of prep. I played it fairly flawlessly, and then if you asked me to do it now, I couldn't.
Oh, my God.
Just gone from my brain.
So actually, how obsessed do you have to be as good as you are to become a concert violinist? Because I don't think I've got that sort of commitment.
Is it the 10,000 hours thing? Have you heard of this? You have to do 10,000 hours of practice to be good at anything?
I've heard of that. I think there's a large element of bollocks in that number.
You need 10,000 bollocks? To
wow. 10,000 banana fingers.
Yeah. All right, behave.
Luckily, I think I've got quite a naturally obsessive personality anyway, so it didn't seem crazy.
And is there a piece of music that you haven't cracked yet, that you've determined to be able to play and you just haven't got to it yet?
There's a lot that I've not got around to because I'm spending my days on YouTube trying to learn skills. No,
but pickling, that's a marketable skill.
Yeah, but do you know what? I did actually pickle those lemons, and they had been sitting in the fridge uneaten for about a year and a half now.
Like those pickles.
Sorry, but if they're pickled, do they need to be in the fridge?
Well, I wondered that.
Because they're pickled.
You need to watch a YouTube video to find out.
Yes. That's obviously the next...
I think maybe after you open the pickles. After you open them, you have to refrigerate them. But if you made them yourself, you were present at the moment before it was...
Of its birth.
When it was open.
Well, exactly. How do you know when it's opened?
Well, there's a YouTube video on best before dates. It tells you how to date your pickles.
So what is the hardest thing that you've ever had to play that you can actually play and do it now without the music,
with a blindfold,
yeah,
and backwards. No hands.
Well, with your feet.
That's hard to say, but when it comes to film stuff, when it comes to film recordings, they usually put the stuff in front of your eyes when you sit down and you play it, and it can be a little bit fiendish. Fortunately, you don't remember it the next day. But I imagine there's been some quite difficult stuff that's completely gone out of my head.
What's the most exciting venue you've ever played? Like this is a dream come true. You've got 5 seconds to answer. Go.
It's clearly here, isn't it?
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, this is the ultimate.
Yeah.
I found that completely crazy that when you're playing on a movie soundtrack, that you'll go to the recording studio, you'll sit down, they'll put the music in front of you, and that's the first time you've seen it. Is that true? You don't get to rehearse or anything?
No, that is absolutely true. And the thing is about that, this country, I don't know how many people know that a lot of these big scores are done here. A lot of the big blockbuster scores come over to the UK to get scored, because we've got wonderful musicians here who can sit down and play what's put in front of them. And that's quite a big deal. The thing that bothers me is that actually you never find out who those people are, because they're never in the credits.
Mm. That's shocking.
And you get, like, outrageous. Mr. Pacino's driver and the craft services people credited, but not the musicians.
You absolutely
And the production do. Babies.
And, you know, I mean, all credit to the drivers. They got to drive around and, you know, the cars...
No, screw those guys. Screw the drivers.
But you don't know...
No, that gets you in trouble. Well, man. Look at Harvey Weinstein.
My family hate me because I make them sit and watch all the credits, and I would stay the extra 10 minutes to see every musician who's played on the piece of music, because it's that hard, and I respect that.
We've got your medal outside.
And the award for best speech goes to...
Thank you.
He's not going to get you comps to Hamilton, all right? Just leave it.
So when you're playing on a movie soundtrack, what are some of the movie soundtracks that you've actually contributed to? Let's give you credit now where credit is due.
You mean played or written?
Played.
Played.
Lord of the Rings?
Lord of the Rings. It's all gone. I think the last Fast and Furious film.
You did some Elfman stuff, am I right in thinking that? No.
Yes, the last
Dumbo.
The big years, Dumbo.
Dumbo.
Prince Charles? No, Dumbo. Okay.
There's a running theme on Dumbo today.
And so more importantly, was composed.
Composed.
The Human Centipede, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you actually watch the film to compose the music for it? Because it's quite a troubling film.
It is a troubling film. Yeah, and there are some scenes which I could never watch. There are some scenes which I watch through with fingers in front of my eyes, which I'm showing you now on the radio, because that's...
Is that the bit in the film? Is that the bit in the film where there's just no music? It just stops.
crying, screaming.
But you know, in horror films, there's some particular kinds of horror that get to you more than others. I can't watch finger things.
Yeah.
There's a scene in Black Swan where she has some kind of vision with her fingernail. I couldn't
body horror stuff, yeah. Like, yeah.
Yes.
The Fly, that's a good
Fly
one.
Fly is the ultimate body horror movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a lot of The Human Centipede was fine. One or two scenes I never watched.
I mean, it's a terrible concept. Like, it's a horrible concept. The whole thing is... Like,
yeah, how do you come up with a tune when you see, well, here's a scene in which, you know, a man's lips are... sewn to the anus of the it's like, oh, you know, I've got such a beautiful tune for that. It's like, you know, how do you come up with something that's appropriate for that?
Chariots of Fire, right? That's
yeah. Slip that.
luckily they didn't want any tunes. They wanted one kind of painful noise that goes from the beginning to the end, and that we could give them.
I can.
So did you just go? So he's like, ooh, ouch, and a violin.
But everything works with the Benny Hill music. But
yeah, man.
So what made you want to get into this particular sphere of being a musician? I mean, particularly film music. Was it growing up with great scores, some of which we play today?
I think it was E.T.
Really?
I think it was probably E.T., which I would have been 4 or 5. And that was a particularly memorable film because I didn't know we were going. And my dad took me to the cinema. And that was, it was obviously too exciting a thing to actually be going to a film. And he told me he was buying tickets for the next day. And when we actually went into the cinema, I was so excited about that fact on its own that it was already one of the greatest things that I could imagine. And that music actually stuck with me.
Bizarre. It is a great score. I mean, obviously you've got
4 or 5, but it really stuck with me.
Everyone knows the main theme, but I play quite often the bicycle chase and the end credits theme. It's just amazing piece of music.
It is. So it was that, probably.
Follow up question to that: you know, when they go up in the air, why do they keep pedalling?
Because they're shitting themselves. They're like, I'm 200 foot up in the air.
Because it's E.T.'s mind powers or his, you know, alien powers that's got them. And yet they're pedaling away
furiously. But that's showing faith in his powers. It's all about faith. That's what the movie's about, Marshall.
Is it? And what's that got to do with pedaling?
Well, if you stop pedaling, you don't believe in it.
I don't know. I feel like there are.
That just sounds like bullshit to me. I mean, I asked an incredibly stupid question, but that doesn't seem like even a close to the answer.
I feel like the first time you take off and fly on a bike, you don't sort of experiment with what's keeping you up there.
Yeah, I wouldn't stop pedaling.
Yeah. Just for safety.
You wouldn't see me stop pedaling, mate. Not a chance.
I would shit myself. Yeah. But it went against the sun, you would see a lot more than just
a trail.
So you compose with a partner, Holic Spies. He's based in France.
Yes.
So how do you do that? Do you do different bits of music each? Do you do a note each? You kind of send it backwards and forwards?
A little bit. We send it backwards and forwards. And sometimes he starts a cue if I feel like, if it seems like it's his kind of thing a little bit more than mine. But we have the same system. And we could be working in the same office, except his happens to be in the wilderness in the middle of France. And mine happens to be in Wandsworth.
Do you have similar voices musically, or is it clashing?
I feel
styles?
Like well, it's
not clashing.
Maybe it's one stage, yes, because I mean he comes from a sort of DJ background and a producer, and he's got this incredible sort of imagination for sound. And I'm from where I'm from, but we're kind of a band. I mean, it's we both write music together, and it's music we wouldn't do on our own. So no, not really anymore.
Okay.
So Patrick, your chosen subject for the Vintage Geek Quiz is The Simpsons. Now I do have a Simpsons chapter in my book, but I didn't. You know, you've all got copies of the book, so I wasn't going to ask those. It's fine. So I got 3 new, very simple, because actually his questions were quite hard. So it's like let's go.
But you know everything about film. I couldn't give you easy questions.
No, I know when I got the answers in front of me for sure. Okay, so question one. Mm. As finally revealed in the season 16 episode Homer and Ned's Hail Mary Pass, what is Comic Book Guy's real name? What is Comic Book Guy's real name?
Comic Book Guy's real name? Well, that's a question that would be really easy.
If you knew the answer.
Yeah. Does anybody know? Okay. No, I could give you the first name, if that might help. Does anybody know it?
I didn't even know we knew it.
Is it something like John Smith?
No, his first name is Jeff. First name, Jeff.
Oh.
Jeff Albertson. Jeff Albertson. Best question ever.
I never, ever heard that ever.
Well, now you have.
It's not that I'm kicking myself and thinking, well, of course it's Jeff Albertson. Jeff
Patrick, Albertson. Are you ever going to forget that now?
I never will.
I remember being so excited when he said his name in that episode. It was life-changing.
Is it meant to mean something, or is it just a random name?
It's just a random name.
Oh, okay.
Well, all names are random.
But I thought it was supposed to be clever. Like, okay.
But that's odd. Like, I mean...
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's just the answer.
You just brought the mood down.
I did.
You just killed it.
Right, let's move on. Okay, hold on.
Tuesday Takeover with Marshall Julius on FUBAR Radio.
Yeah, shut up. It's my name. Okay. Right, question number two. Paul and Linda McCartney agreed to guest star on the season 7 episode Lisa the Vegetarian on what condition?
Was it that they plug her sausages?
They sacrificed a horse? No? Okay.
I have no idea, but how do you plug a sausage?
With your banana
fingers.
With
your banana fingers. Ask for Ariel's.
Actually, their condition for appearing on the show was that Lisa, who becomes a vegetarian in the episode, was that she would remain a vegetarian for the entire run of the show, that she wouldn't just like go back to being a meat eater after.
They could go back. Linda's not paying any attention now. They can go back on that.
Condemning Lisa to meatless decades. Decades of meatlessness.
Oh, my God.
Well, she's been 10 for like 100 years, so there's worse things happening for
That's
her.
Because she doesn't eat meat.
Yeah.
And okay. She's, in real life, she's a big champion of your book, Marshall.
She is. Oh, she is. No, I love her.
That was amazing.
Nice segue.
Yardley Smith.
Yeah, she's great. She's done like two quizzes already online. So I'm going to create a quiz about her for her to try and answer. So, you know, we'll see. But apparently I ask questions that are impossible to answer, so she probably won't know anything about herself either. Okay, question number three. Okay, who are Poonam, Sashi, Priya, Uma, Anoop, Sandeep, Nabendu, and Geet?
Apu's kids.
Yes, they are. Yeah. The Nahasapima Petalon octoplets.
Yes.
The result of fertility drugs slipped into Manjula's breakfast squishy by her husband.
And so what happens now that, you know, because Hank said he's not going to voice Apu anymore, do those characters just disappear from the show completely?
Well, presumably. Usually when an actor kind of dies, they don't bring the characters back.
Lisa's going to eat him. That's going to be the payoff.
So is there no Quickie Mart anymore?
I haven't seen the last few episodes, so I don't know.
I haven't seen the last 15 years, so, you know.
So I'm not sure. But I think that he's just made that decision now, which means that they probably recorded several episodes to go.
I'm going
to
miss Apu.
I miss him too. Hmm. Well, Patrick, thank you very much for coming on and for plucking for us and for your musical knowledge. Thank you very much. Let's give Patrick a round of applause.
Thank you for having me. It's been brilliant.
Now let's listen to some music. So that was, what is it, Alexander Desplat, Desplat? How do you pronounce his name? Does anybody know? That was
I can spell it, but I don't know how to pronounce
it. I'm assuming Desplat is better than Desplat.
From the Grand Pont West Hotel. So, So yes, we got one quiz left, I think.
Yeah, well, Marshall, listen. You've been asking us questions all day, and you are the quiz master. You've got a fantastic book called Vintage Geek.
Vintage Geek.
With a thousand amazing drops. Questions, including 50 from noted celebrities from around the world.
Like
Mark Hamill. John Carpenter. Like me.
Yes.
That's the worst question.
No, you should have
started
right?
with that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I know.
Now George Takei. George Takei. John Carpenter. Did you say that? No. Okay.
So it's now time to turn the high-powered finger of perception back in your own direction. How good are you? We're about to find out. So now I'm going to ask you three questions. Now, what was your chosen subject?
See, I thought that we'd have run out of time by this and I wouldn't have to. But I said Tales of Time Travel.
Well, here we go. I've got three. You asked me to do five, but I've got three. So I'm going to start now.
Okay, just hold on a second.
Tuesday Takeover with Marshall Julius on FUBAR Radio.
Unbelievable.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for.
Okay, so here goes. Now, listen, you're not allowed to misanswer with a button here. I'm not going to have that.
Sure.
Question number one from the movie Planet of the Apes, one that's been very dear to us for many years. Whose theory of time travel is cited in the original movie, and in what other original Apes movie do we get to meet the scientist involved?
I got no idea.
Okay,
no
it's
idea.
Dr. Otto Haslein, who believes the chimpanzee hero Sarah Cornelius must be killed in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, played by Eric Braeden.
Yeah, I honestly.
Good old Eric Braeden.
Question two. Now, we've learnt something today. We've learnt that actually Ray Harryhausen should have made the time machine and not George Pell. And this question is about the 1960 time machine movie.
She was here answering these questions.
So here we go. We know that Rod Taylor played the pioneering time traveller, one H. George Wells, in the movie.
Yes.
But what does the movie have in common with the classic TV show Mr. Ed that Dave Johns mentioned just before? And I'll give you enough time to think this through.
Jesus
they
Christ!
They used to stick him with a pin to make him act.
No, I'm going to sing the song while you think it over. That's the time you
got
to
guess
it.
Okay, what does Mr. Ed have in common with the time machine?
Yeah. So do you remember the theme?
Yes.
Can you sing it?
I can sing that. I don't know the answer.
Well, let's sing it together.
Okay.
Horses are horses, of course, and no one can tell them. Horses, of course, unless, of course, you know that horse is the famous Mr. Ed. Exactly. Time up now. What's the answer?
Well, I was singing. The answer is the guy that does the voice for Mr.
It's actually Alan Young. Alan Young played Wilbur Post in that show. Which ran an incredible 6 seasons, and he's also
all right,
George's
just
best
hang
friend.
On a second.
Tuesday Takeover with Marshall Julius on FUBAR Radio.
Okay, so let's just say. Okay, all right, sorry.
And we're going to move over now, and it's also been mentioned. The answer's been mentioned tonight. So on the subject of H.G. Wells
tonight,
what does Herbert George and Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise have in common? You must know this. If you don't get this. I don't know if we can talk.
They have pickled lemons.
And the answers have been given tonight by one of your guests already.
What has Captain Kirk and H.G. Wells, what do they have in common? Time travel?
Yes, but that's not the answer.
Both their toupees are made from Mr. Ed.
They all have banana fingers.
I'll give you a clue, because I'm being nice here. There's a director that's been involved with both those people.
Nicholas Meyer directed...
Give yourself a ping. That's right.
Oh, thank God. Time after time. My favourite time travel story.
Exactly.
He also saved the Star Trek franchise with Star Trek 2, Star Trek 4 and Star Trek 6.
But let's stick with Star Trek Wrath of Khan for your bonus question.
Bonus question.
On this.
Bonus question.
What is the best quote from Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan?
Khan!
Yeah, you got it. I mean, I would have given you the needs of the many outweigh whatever, but no. Khan it has to be. No, well done, Marshall.
Hey.
See, that's me giving myself ticks, but that's very generous. And, you know, I actually think that we have a little bit of time left.
It's pointed out to me today that Boris Johnson looks like a Morlock from the from the Time Machine, and now I can't unsee it.
No, I can't unsee it either. What a great movie that is. It is a tremendous film. If you haven't seen it yet, listeners, please go and see it now.
It's only been out 70 years, so you should better catch it somewhere.
So, we have... We have some Batman questions for you, Fraser, because
we've
got
Fraser.
A few minutes and you think
this
you're
is just going to be cruel,
So, okay, you chose Batman.
I started
off by saying you wanted to do all of comics.
Yeah, all of comics since the beginning
of
time.
All of comics, which I thought was a little broad, even broader than Ron's subject.
But unfortunately, we're out of time. So.
Yeah, so in 1988,
yep.
DC Comics invited fans to call in and
vote. The death of Robin.
The death of Robin.
Oh, that's impressive.
10,000 votes were cast. Do you know kind of what the margin was for the kind
I don't know what the margin was. I know because it was Jason Todd and everyone hated him.
8,000.
28 votes.
Is that always in it?
It was. That was the difference.
Right. And they made a fortune because it was a premium number, so they made a small fortune on that.
Yeah, they did. Do you know how he was killed?
Yeah, he was blown up by the Joker.
Blown up by the Joker. But didn't he, like, come back?
He's now the Red Hood. He came back 20-odd years later.
So actually he didn't die at all?
No.
He was also a redhead. It was bullshit.
He was also a redhead who dyed his hair black because people expected Robin to have black hair.
There you go. Okay.
Impressive. Most impressive.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
You get 3 out of 3 at the moment. Question number 2. Who wrote and illustrated the hugely influential 1988 one-shot graphic novel Batman the Killing Joke?
Alan Moore.
And who illustrated it?
Brian Bolland.
Even I could have got that.
Yeah.
Very good.
I've got a signed copy.
Yeah. Okay. Question number 3. Held by powerful magnets onto a floating ocean boy... Now that's boy.
Like Robin, like a boy.
B-U-O-Y. Okay. You know, it's actually pronounced...
Bowie.
It's not pronounced Bowie, it's pronounced boy.
In England, in America it's
pronounced My name is David Boy.
Okay, but it's
we're in England now, I know.
You can't use magnets to attach someone to a boy. No. Unless I suppose they've got like metal on... Okay, no, let's... Held by powerful magnets onto a floating ocean buoy in Batman's Campus Christmas 1966 feature, how do the Caped Crusader and Robin the Boy Wonder survive the final torpedo that whooshes towards them with deadly urgency?
I wish I remembered. I remember the scene. Bat oil. They worm their way out.
Nope. As the sequence, it cuts from, there's the sound of an explosion and then they're away on their bat boat. And Robin says, gosh, Batman, the nobility of the almost human purpose.
Oh.
And Batman says, true, Robin, it was noble of that animal to hurl himself into the path of that final torpedo.
Suicidal dolphin.
And the best quote from Batman, the 1966 movie, there's no question, there's only one.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
By the way, dibs on Suicidal Dolphin as a band name. I'm taking that now.
Well... All that remains is for me to thank my guests. Thanks to John Walsh, to Dave Johns and Patrick Savage, plus my cracking co-hosts, Fraser Brown and Ron Fogelman, for taking the time to help me take over this Tuesday here at FUBAR. And for more of my nonsense, you can always find me on Twitter at Marshall Julius by Vintage Geek. Let's end then with one final fantastic track, Enterprising Young Men by Michael Giacchino from 2009's Star Trek reboot.